Chapter 1, Perinatal Developments and a Few Other Bits. I was born in Leamington, now officially known as Royal Leamington Spa, moderately famous for the manufacture of gas cookers. The year was 1942, and the period of gestation ended on the 7th of February during a rather botched-up air raid in which the Germans thought they were hitting Coventry. My parents, Tim and Betty, were outraged when I arrived because they'd been expecting a heterosexual black Jew with several rather amusing birth deformities as they needed the problems. They lived in an enormous Gothic castle in the south of France called Done Drinking Gin and Slimline Tonic with Ice But No Lemon In, which was originally built by Marco Polo for himself and a few friends he wanted to invite round to his place after the pub closed. An awe-inspiring construction of granite and bits of wood, with sweeping lawns recently modified to include an ornamental malaria swamp. He felt a sharp stab of steel in his groin and the sickening sensation of the warm ooze of blood welling up inside his flying jacket. A screaming hail of bullets punched through his left ear as he mused, "Hey, that was my ear." Thinking this over, he continued to massage the coconut milk into her firm, young breasts. He took another mouthful, letting it dribble slowly onto the tip of each erect nipple, and watched it stream tantalizing down towards the moistly quivering lips of her French poodle Kipper. I must admit, so far, that Chapter 1 has not had much more than a grain of truth in it, but it is more interesting than all the usual humdrum wetting of nappies and later pants and not being allowed to sit next to Lottie the Czechoslovakian girl because I once shat myself, seeing bits of people hanging from trees. Oh, that does sound interesting. Perhaps I should put that down. Where was I? Yes, I was 3 at the time, and my mother wanted to take me along to see my father, being a policeman, which is something he did most days. A street in Wigston Magna, 1944. There has just been an explosion in an aircraft in which 9 free Polish airmen had been flying. The force of the explosion has reduced them to their component parts, and one can see quite clearly a lung hanging down from the lower branches of a chestnut tree, a leg on a front lawn, and a hole in the roof of a semi-detached, which was later explained by a lady who came out of the house carrying a bucket with what looked like a liver in it. The 3-year-old boy is not particularly worried because he's holding his mummy's hand, and his daddy is in charge, and being very efficient about trying to sort out bits of human flesh into at least 9 different sacks. Unfortunately, there seem to be only 8 heads and no other suspicious roof holes. Mummy calls out to daddy, "Walter!" "Sorry, dear, I'm busy." "Hey, you, that sack's already got 2 legs in it." Reflecting on this, I go, "Wah!" inwardly, and I'm just thinking of going, "Wah!" outwardly when my mother grabs my hand. "Walter, dear, we were just going out shopping and I thought that Graham might like..." "Look, dear, I'll see you later. Has anyone found that head yet? Hey, has anyone in this street found a head? Come on, someone must have it. I know this street. You'd whip anything. I mean, what the bloody hell are you going to do with a head?" "Well, dear, perhaps we'll go and get your tea." "What? Oh, yes. Egg on toast, please. Left arm here. Anyone missing a left arm?" "We haven't got any eggs. There's a war on." "Ask Harold. Something's bound to have fallen off the back of a lorry." "All right, dear, come on, Graham, stop staring at all that blood. It won't do you any good." "Oh, come on, Mum, this must be one of my major formative experiences." "Ah!" And so, London, 1895, Oscar Wilde's residence. In the glittering drawing room are gathered a glittering group. The cream of London society, the Prince of Wales, James McNeill Whistler, George Bernard Shaw, and Wilde himself are just a few of the notables present. Inevitably, it is Oscar Wilde the party centres around. Raising his glass of champagne, the Prince speaks to his host. "My congratulations, Wilde. Your play is a great success. The whole of London is talking about you." The group waits expectantly for the master of the paradox to be paradoxical. Wilde does not disappoint them. "There is only one thing in the world worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about." For a full minute, the laughter reverberates around the room. Whistler turns puce with envy. Shaw twitches with jealousy. Aubrey Beardsley micturates in pique. Max Beerbohm stuffs a sour grape up his nostril, and Jane Austen revolves in her grave. The Prince claps Oscar on the shoulder. "Very witty, very witty." The game is afoot. Whistler takes a breath and riposts. "There is only one thing worse in the world than being witty, and that is not being witty." It is a hit. The room rocks with laughter for another full minute. Oscar Wilde's face goes as green as his carnation. Shaw winces. Beardsley, feeling a pang of resentment, defecates in a riding boot. Beerbohm enviously punches a hole in a Chinese silk screen, and Jane Austen's false breast falls off. Wilde opines, "I wish I had said that." Whistler smiles at him. He had expected that incisive retort and is ready for it. "You will, Oscar, you will." Wilde waves an effete hand in the direction of Whistler. "Your Highness, do you know James McNeil Whistler?" Ducking the effete hand, the prince declares, "Yes, we play squash together." Wilde is in like a rapier. "There is only one thing worse than playing squash together, and that is playing it by yourself." He waits expectantly for the roars of laughter and the shrieks of glee. They do not come. The silence grows longer. So does Shaw's beard. Eventually, Oscar mutters, "I wish I hadn't said that." Seeing his bosom friend with egg on his face, Whistler cannot resist the temptation to throw an omelette. "You did, Oscar, you did." The room rocks with laughter. Exhausted with the excellence of the wit and the gay bonhomie, the prince bids his host farewell. "You must forgive me, Wilde, but I must get back up the palace." Wilde is desperate. It's unheard of. The Prince of Wales leaving with a smile on his face that had not been put there by Oscar Wilde. He blurts, "Your Majesty, you are like a big jam donut with cream on top." A shocked hush descends on the room. The Prince of Wales, like his mother on a previous occasion, is not amused. "I beg your pardon." Wilde splutters, completely at a loss. It was one of Whistler's." The game is now not merely afoot, it's putting the boot in. "I didn't say that." "You did, James, you did." The Prince of Wales and the assembled company gaze expectantly at Whistler. For a moment, the celebrated painter is at a loss. Then, "I meant that, like a doughnut, your arrival gives us pleasure, and your departure makes us hungry for more." Loud laughter and applause follow this elegant explanation. Encouraged, Whistler moves on to the attack. "Your Majesty is like a stream of bat's piss." Over the gasps, the Prince of Wales thunders, "I beg your pardon?" Coolly, the painter gazes at the prince. "It was one of Wilde's." How will the hero of a thousand cul-de-sacs cope with this one? The gathering does not have to wait long for an answer. The mind that has been sharpened to a sword's edge through years of verbal fencing rises brilliantly to the occasion. "It sodding well wasn't. It was one of Shaw's." Bernard Shaw totters visibly as the buck that has been passed him hangs heavily round his neck. But this is the man destined to write Arms and the Man, and its astonishing sequel, Armpits and the Woman. Smiling at the prince, he speaks softly, "I merely meant, Your Majesty, that you shine out like a shaft of gold when all around is dark." There is a ripple of awed admiration. The ease with which Shaw had escaped from the sinking ship has been remarkable. Shaw has been put on his mettle by a fellow Irishman, and to Shaw, a fellow Irishman is fair game. He gives Wilde a wicked look, and then coolly drops the doyen of distinguished society in the ordure. "Your Majesty is like a dose of clap." There is a collective gasp of horror. The horror becomes near panic when Shaw, not waiting for the prince's superb rejoinder of, "I beg your pardon," continues, "Before you arrive is pleasure, but after a pain in the dong." The Prince of Wales pales in anger, and there is a lot of him. There is a lot of pale. "What?" he shrieks. Then Shaw places MasterCard. "It was one of Wilde's." Every eye in the room looks at Oscar Wilde, including the bloodshot pair belonging to the Prince of Wales. "I'm waiting, Wilde. I'm waiting." New York, 1976. The City Center Theater. A packed house. Monty Python's Flying Circus is appearing. We are in mid-sketch. Whistler is being played by John Cleese. Shaw is being played by Michael Palin. The Prince of Wales is being played by Terry Jones. I am playing Oscar Wilde. And I have just dried. I cannot remember the next line. The entire theater waits. And as they wait, so do I, for that damned line to enter my head. It refuses to come. I am beginning to break out into a sweat. The line just won't come. John Cleese shuffles uncomfortably and mutters, "Get on with it." Thinking this is a prompt, I proclaim loudly, "Get on with it." The reaction of the audience gives me the definite impression this is not my line. It's at moments like this when one thinks, "Oh, fuck it, does it really matter? What are we all here for? Are we predestined to take the paths we follow?" And sure enough, as though to prove a point, I was actually in Los Angeles a year later. We extinguished our cigarettes and fastened our seat belts, and then did it again in French and Spanish, as the first-class lounge of the mighty British Airways Boeing 747 banked sharply to the left. Captain Chet Bigglesberg's crisp Oxford drawl slid powerfully through the intercom. "Listen, y'all. What ho? How are y'all? Anyway, jolly good. We'll all be, like, sort of landing and things in sort of y'all, Los Angeles in approximately sort of 15 minutes from this point-style moment in time, instance-wise, y'all. That is to say, landingization will be completed sort of, in a bit, as of now, y'all. Toodle-pip, sort of, what? Ho? Click. Frightfully sorry, y'all. Click." The enormous bar glid to a halt, and I and my financial advisor, Major Sloan, were ushered from our divans by the now-nude Cypriot debutante air hostess. She offered us our disembarkation executive foot modules, vinylized nylonette uppers, hand-stitched onto personalized red carpetlet soles, a touching modern reminder of a never-existent old-world charm. In our 64-foot, four-seater Cadillac, we executived off downtown for the premiere of Muhammad Ali's film, The Greatest, an excellent movie, a damn sight better than Jaws or Saturday Night Fever, which was rejected by black and white audiences alike for simply telling the truth. Or could the distributors have found its portrayal of parasitical white middlemen uncomfortably astute? The select open-air reception afterwards at the vast Plaza de los Reganos drew a huge crowd of spectators, all eager to see the champ arrive stylishly by helicopter. All eyes gazed heavenwards as Muhammad Ali, in a typically flamboyant gesture, walked quietly in from the back and mingled with the guests. He was soon spotted by hordes of film, television and press cameramen who would have made personal contact impossible had he not politely ignored them. Like any decent actor, he simply wanted to know how the film had gone. As at all film premieres, most people were standing around trying to look as though they knew the star so well that they didn't even need to acknowledge his presence, and merely peered around, wondering whether anyone had noticed them. Five people were so famous, they didn't even need to turn up, and their vacant spaces were stared at with awe. There was going to be Sammy Davis Jr., and over there would have been Frank Sinatra, if his trichologist hadn't ordered him to sit at home in a chair. The other boxing aficionados were so indescribably famous they had to hire three separate stadiums to be absent at. I have never seen so much awe. I left them all to it, and congratulated the man himself on a great performance. He knew that I meant what I had said, and we sat down and chatted for 20 minutes. I found him kind, perceptive and wise, and unlike some who pass for intelligent, capable of listening to others. He must have seen something in me too, otherwise I wouldn't have lasted a full 20 minutes. We talked about religion, black and gay liberation, and the fear that drives man to destroy man. Certainly one of the most fascinating conversations in my life. But the gin that had given me the courage to talk to him in the first place also made me completely forget everything that we said. What a wasted opportunity. Sorry, everybody, but Major Sloan is trying to arrange a return bout on more equal terms now that I'm back in training. I thanked the greatest, we shook hands, and I walked back into the crowd. My head was buzzing. Everything went beige with little patches of russet, and I was aware of a sensation of violent speed as I was crushed by gigantic G-forces against the granite steps of the David Niven Memorial, which seemed to be hurtling out into the black abyss of space. "This is no time for musing," I mused. Suddenly it seemed that a hole had been torn in the very fabric of space. Was I being sucked into a black hole rent in the great donut of eternity? "Don't be silly," I thought. "Of course you are." It was almost as if I was being drawn along a powerful tractor beam towards some unearthly giant starship. As luck would have it, I was. "Well, well, this is a turn-up," I said to myself, thinking, what a strange thing to say. It must have been my upbringing which brought about my following action, for at moments of great stress, I always think of people hanging in trees. I threw up. Small bits of tomato skin, sweet corn husks, and diced carrot moved out into an elliptical orbit around the sun. There before me was an immense cylindrical structure, oblate in cross-section, 9.2 kilometers long, 1.92 kilometers across its longer elliptical axis, and 1.56 kilometers down its shorter elliptical axis. Its further end seemed to be glowing with an eerie incandescent power, and the brown, fluted, longitudinal striations made it look for all the world like a lighted Peter Stuyvesant that had just been gently sat on by someone wearing slightly damp corduroy trousers, but twice as sinister. The force beam in which I was trapped was still drawing me and the minuscule portion of what had once been Los Angeles into an entrance bay in what would have been the middle section of a filter tip, if it had actually been a cigarette as described and not a bloody great spaceship. As usual in these situations, I now lost consciousness, being overcome with horror at the thought of all the descriptive detail that would otherwise have been needed. Everything went black. Absolutely everything. I couldn't see a damn thing but utter blackness. Until, suddenly, I woke up out of my extremely well-thought-out insensibility and found myself on the bridge of the starship, which, as luck would have it, was completely indescribable. I slowly became aware of a strange group of totally unimaginable, my luck was still holding, creatures crowded round a cluster of scanning screens. To my astonishment, I saw that they were watching fictional reruns from my encounter with puberty, what we doctors refer to as Chapter 2.